This bill of impeachment goes to the Senate, which receives it and sits as a judicial body with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding, hears testimony, and then votes guilt or acquittal. Last Sunday, I was of the conviction that the House of Representatives ought to begin considering bringing an act of impeachment, bill of impeachment against President Nixon. Midweek, when the President agreed to abide by the rules of the federal court in the matter of the tapes, I felt it would be better if we proceeded with the various investigations that were then underway, a due process and judicial review. After the President's press conference of Friday night, I was no longer so sure that patience was the virtue. As an historian, I am convinced that power and the abuse of power always go hand in hand. There are very few people in all of history who have ever had great power and not at one time or another abused it. And I am firmly of the conviction that power and corruption also are constant companions. I'm not one who is much surprised that a vice president is discovered to be a petty crook and an extortionist. But I believe it to be the genius of the American system. That law rules. That no man is above the law, that when necessary, the law can reach in and pluck out those who are in the highest places and require that they appear and answer for their acts before the bar of justice. It may be that the President of the United States will turn out to be as venal and as greedy as his own vice president. If the rumors circulating in Washington dealing with Mr. Hughes's contributions and Mr. Rebozo and his bag, with the various unreported sums, and with the strange acquisition of millions of dollars worth of property by the president, prove out to have any validity, then it seems to me quite fitting and proper that the same fate be presented to our president as to our vice president. I believe that Americans are blessed by a unique social experiment begun at the very beginning of our history, which insisted that man is weak and man is fallible, and as the Puritans and Pilgrims well knew, that man is sinful, prone to look out inordinately for himself. We do not assume men to be saints or kings to be saints or men in high places, presidents to be saints. What we assume is a law. The law is inviolate, and that all men must ultimately be accountable before that law. Now, the issue this last week was not what the president tried to make it seem, that he had, through his attorney general, appointed a special investigator, Mr. Cox, for the Watergate. That as the chief executive, this investigator was responsible to him, and that because Mr. Cox had been willful, apparently, according to the president, because Mr. Cox had been out to get him, he had to be dismissed from his office and from his trust. The issue was rather that the courts had ruled that the president was to release these famous or infamous tapes, and had given the president, because he is, after all, our president, various options. He was, if possible, to work out with the special prosecutor a way for releasing these tapes that was suitable to the special prosecutor, which would not restrict him in the exercise of his special duty to investigate everything pertinent to the issue, and that once this was done, the constitutional crisis in which the tapes involved would be over. Mr. Nixon was mandated to come up with a means of releasing the tapes which was acceptable to Mr. Cox. Instead of which, he ordered Mr. Cox to accept a plan which was acceptable to him, to the president. And Mr. Cox did not make the final determination. He did not set his will as an individual against that of the president. Rather, he said, as I understand my office, I cannot discharge it properly, investigate thoroughly with this kind of proposal. Mr. President, you take this proposal back to Judge Sirica's court and see if the judge accepts it as being in compliance with the court's rule. It was because the president was unwilling to take the issue back to the courts and instead simply ordered the attorney general to dismiss Mr. Cox that America last week was plunged into a major and severe constitutional crisis. The president tried to say essentially that he had some presidential right to determine the limits within which this particular investigation should be carried out. These rights were more important, more significant, more dominant, more sovereign, if you will, than those of the courts. And that theory runs counter to every principle on which this republic is based. My firm conviction, my firm faith in a society under law, is grounded not only in my appreciation of the freedoms and the social order which we have managed over 200 years to develop here in these United States, but also on my understanding of our biblical tradition and all that it represents. Ancient Israel was, as you know, a rude agglomeration of tribes. Each tribe had a kind of primitive democracy. There were tribal elders, and when there was a need for the tribe to meet together for some kind of common decision, the elders would meet in council and a decision would be made. And when all of the tribes needed to meet because of the danger, usually of some external attack, they would summon what was called Kol Yisrael, an assembly of all of the tribes, and the sheikhs, each in his turn, would speak his piece, and there would be some kind of rudimentary consensus, and some action would be taken. Now, this kind of primitive, of early democracy, was a very satisfying way for the tribes to live. But when they conquered Canaan and settled in, and began to develop there a culture, a way of life, a standard of living, which was attractive to enemies without, because there's always somebody in the world who wants what you have if what you have is worth taking. When the Edomites and the Moabites and the Elamites began to attack, most especially when the Philistines began to attack and attack successfully, it became patently evident that the kind of rude democracy which the tribes had was too tardy, too erratic to be able to raise the armies and to administer the nation, the tribes, in the face of this kind of danger. And so we're told in the Bible that the tribes appealed to the great religious figure of their day, Samuel, and they said to Samuel, appoint for us a leader, with a capital L. Let us have a king like unto all the kings that are in the countries about us. A king who will lead our armies, who will be the general, who will tell us what to do so we're not going off in all directions at once, so that we can do what is necessary to save our nation. And Samuel appointed the king, Saul, and then David, because Samuel recognized the emergency. But at the same time, that he bowed to the will of the people, he warned them. He said to them, there's going to come a time when you will cry out in the bitterness of your soul against the king whom you have now appointed. For he will conscript your young men, not only for his army, but for his court. And he will require your young women to be in his harem, in his household. And he will levy terrible heavy taxes upon you for his indulgences and for his luxuries. And he will expropriate your land for his favorites and for his successful generals. Power and the abuse of power have always gone hand in hand. And how to regulate, to limit the prerogatives, the abuse by those who have power, has been one of the critical questions facing mankind from the beginning of social history. We find in our Bibles a number of laws which try to limit the arrogance, the tyranny of the king. The king, according to the book of Deuteronomy, is not allowed to levy inordinate taxes. He is not allowed to maintain a standing army. Only in emergency is Israel to be conscripted. And he is not allowed to maintain too large a harem, too large and too costly a court. But obviously there were abuses in those days, even as there are in our days. And Israel tried symbolically as well as legally to convince the king that he was under Torah, under God's will, under the law. How? According to the book of Deuteronomy, at his inauguration, when he is invested with all the authority of kingly rule, the king has the responsibility to write out by hand a Torah scroll, all of the laws of God. And he's also mandated to have this scroll read to him every day of his life, that he will always be conscious that there is no divine right of kings to rule as they see fit. That the king is empowered to rule only as long as he rules within the limits set by the law of God. And when the kings of Israel abused their privilege, there arose in Israel the prophets like Nathan and Elijah and Jeremiah, who went into the very palace of the king and pointed the finger and said, thou art the man who has abused your privilege. You have violated the will of God. You have exceeded your prerogatives. God will see to it that you will suffer for it. I would submit to you that there is a direct connection between this biblical theory that power must be limited by the rule of law and the judgments which have been rendered recently, first by Judge Sirica, and then by the majority in the Federal Court of Appeals who reviewed Judge Sirica's decision. Judge Sirica spoke with a biblical tongue when he wrote, in all candor, the court fails to perceive any reason for suspending the power of the courts. For suspending the power of the courts to get evidence and rule on questions of privilege in criminal matters simply because it is the President of the United States who holds the evidence. David walks in with Nathan walks into King David, points the finger, and says to him, thou hast violated the commandments. You ordered this woman's husband to be killed. You took her to yourself as wife. You are the man, and you must be punished. In criminal matters, no man is above the law. And the federal court went on, and the district court went on and added, though the president is elected by nationwide ballot, and is often said to represent all the people, he does not embody the nation's sovereignty. He is not above the law's commands. Sovereignty remains at all times with the people, and they do not forfeit through elections the right to have the law construed against and applied to every citizen. That's the biblical spirit. And that's the American spirit. And that's the only spirit, dear friends, in which a democracy can survive. For the minute that we assume that someone is above the law, we have tyranny and not democracy. Now, the president midweek bowed to the courts. Professor Wright appeared in Judge Sirica's courts and agreed to abide in each and every respect with the decision which Judge Sirica had rendered. Most of us felt relieved. The question which then seemed to face us was a question of procedure rather than a question of an immediate constitutional crisis. And this question of procedure is a complicated one. And it was complicated even more by the president's press conference of Friday night. For he announced then, as you recall, that yes, there would be another special prosecutor appointed. But when he was asked specifically whether that prosecutor would have the right to go into the courts to subpoena any and all documents which he deemed to be relevant to the issue, the answer was no answer at all. It was a long-winded, rather pious statement that the president couldn't conceive of any issue in which this particular right of the prosecutor, of the investigator, would have to be exercised. And yet that was precisely the issue which had forced the crisis of the weekend before. The first attempt of the president, after he dismissed Mr. Cox, the first attempt to continue and to bring to an end something he devoutly hopes to accomplish, the Watergate investigation, was to say that this investigation should be continued by the Justice Department. Well, that's where it all began. And it was Mr. Peterson and the Justice Department, which in July of 1972, after the break-in of the Democratic National Headquarters, understood, and these are the words of the testimony of John Dean before the Senate Committee, understood the importance of restricting the investigation because of the urgency of the elections. The Justice Department is the servant of the president. And in this case, the president is one of the people under investigation. And there can be no justice when the person under investigation can determine the limits, the parameters of the investigation itself. The president then seemed to back away from this particular conclusion, and he came to the idea that Mr. Bork, the acting attorney general, would appoint a new special investigator, but that this special investigator would not have the power of subpoena. He would be proclaimed independent, but in fact be dependent. And it seems to me critical that the House, the Senate, insist that a special investigator be appointed who is totally and completely independent. Yes, there are dangers. There are dangers that an independent investigator working out of Judge Sirica's court or responsible to the Congress may unbalance temporarily the traditional balance of powers between the legislative, the judicial, and the executive branch. But I submit to you, dear friends, that the crisis of confidence in our nation has so unbalanced, so frustrated this nation, brought it really to a standstill, that unless we bend a little bit and assure ourselves that we are going to find the facts and follow the leads wherever they may lead, we are consigning ourselves to 2.5 more years of incapacity and frustration and inaction. And that's a fate which, in our changing and dangerous world, really America cannot accept. During the week in which all of this was breaking, The word came out that the United States had proclaimed a military alert throughout the world. It wasn't quite clear at the beginning why this alert was called, and then gradually the news came out that the Russians had mobilized and there was danger that three large paratroop divisions were going to be airlifted from the satellite countries in South Russia into Egypt in order to relieve the encircled Third Egyptian Army on the east bank, southeast bank of the Suez Canal. And during the days, the 2 days, 2.5 days when this matter was in the news, I was stopped every 10 minutes or so by someone who said to me, "Rabbi, is this just another ploy of the president?" There was an absolute suspension of belief in the veracity of the president of the United States. I am convinced that if the president had had Mr. Kissinger's press conference of the first day, he would not have been believed. Mr. Kissinger is to a certain degree still creditable. And in fact, there was a crisis. And in fact, the Russians had mobilized. And in fact, this has been confirmed from Israeli sources. There was a threat. And there was reason to fear the intrusion of massive Russian arms and armies into the Middle East. But no one believed the president. Mr. Kissinger, in his press conference on Wednesday, said there must be a minimum of confidence in the administration. And I hardly found that minimum. People who are not among the traditional Satanists as far as Mr. Nixon is concerned, because there is a certain proportion of people in these United States who have hated Mr. Nixon for 20 years and see him only as the devil and have always had a conspiracy theory about everything that he does. These weren't only the people who mistrusted what he was saying. You and I did. Average, ordinary people. And that's a tragedy. It's a tragedy because we cannot believe we've so often have been told and found what we were told to be untrue. The president is not believed, dear friends, not because of the way he speaks, not because of his manner in press conference, but simply because so much of what he said has been proven out to be unbelievable. He told us that he would wind down the war in Vietnam and promptly proclaim the war under a new term, pacification. It sounded peaceful, but it was war under another name. He told us that the war would be limited to Vietnam. And then he ordered the Department of Defense to falsify its flight strike records, its bombing records, so that even elements of the command, and certainly the press, the American people, would not know that we were bombing routinely in Cambodia and in Laos. He told us that we must believe in law and order, in the courts, in the judicial process. And then 2 years ago, we accepted the Huston Committee report and put into operation a plan which includes the permission of surreptitious entry, of electronics surveillance, of the opening of the mails domestically to find out what you or I or anyone else that he wanted to find out about was thinking, doing. And he did not pull back this plan because he had any kind of sense of its illegality, but rather because one of his officials, Mr. Hoover, was unwilling to go along with it. He spoke of law and order and of the courts, the importance of each citizen doing his share and of respecting the government. And then he, through his minions, opened up the government to every special interest group, every businessman, every corporation that wanted special advantage and was willing to pay tens of thousands of dollars to the reelection coffers. Yes, some of it may not have been known by him. But we heard last week of a letter which was written to him directly by the dairymen, promising $2 million in campaign funds. 2 weeks later, the import quotas on dairy products were made more restrictive and the base price for dairy products was raised. And of course, there's the great question, the unanswered question, whether in fact the president was involved in the cover-up of Watergate from July to November of 1972, the cover-up of a burglary which, if it had been known, would certainly have had a major impact upon the course of the election, upon who is now in the White House. Again and again and again, the president has said one thing and done another. And it's not only scheduling a press conference one day and canceling it for another, that's trivial. But he's explained to us that he was going to end a war here, and he's increased the bombing there. He's explained to us that he was going to put certain controls on here, instead of which the controls were taken off there. He's told us that he was a president for all of the people above the hurly-burly, and obviously people of all kinds of special interest groups have had their special ties to him and to his administration. The president is not believed, because so much he says, said to us, is simply unbelievable. And the decision that you and I and all of us face now is not a happy one, because there is no happy resolution to this whole crisis. To impeach the president is neat, clean, but it would involve America in a divisive political battle from which Mr. Nixon might emerge as a martyr. It would throw the decision into the Congress, into the Senate, not a judicial body at its best, at a time when there is no vice president, when the decision would be made on narrow political lines as well as on judicial lines, because there is now the opportunity for a complete change of administrations with all the exchange of power and that represents. It would end up by being a confrontation in which a great deal would be lost in terms of our ability to ferret out all the others in high office who have been involved in this. And at a time when there is no attorney general and no assistant attorney general and no special investigator, there's really no way to marshal, to arrange the facts effectively, to present them before such a body. And if we do not impeach the president and continue with the long process of investigation, there is the need to assure ourselves that the investigation is thorough and honest and independent, and that those who ought to be are brought ultimately to justice. And there is a sorry image of a country which continues not to believe its chief executive, and whose chief executive seems incapable of solving many of the problems, particularly the domestic problems, the economic problems, because he is so busy trying to succor his own presidency. We really can't win either way. How did the president get into this kind of mess? Mr. Meany suggested this last week that the president is mentally unbalanced. I don't think so. Nor do I believe that the president is the devil. I think the president is consistent. But I think that he is a surprising creature for a lawyer, in that he has simply no respect for the majesty of the law. He's been raised in the school of hard knocks. He's told us so often enough. He's come up the hard way. And he's learned along the way that what counts is to win, to achieve, to complete, to be successful, to do. It's not so much the means as the end. And when one is convinced, as I am sure he is convinced, that the ideals, the hopes he holds for this country are a legitimate end, even a holy end, then to be restrained by such a thing as due process, as the inevitable limitations of power implicit in our American system, is something that this kind of efficient, capable, success-oriented administrator simply does not understand. There's the anomaly of a president who is infinitely successful in foreign affairs and a tragedy on the domestic scene. But I don't think these are two disparate phenomena. They're one and the same thing. In the international arena, there's no law. And if one is too shrewd by far, so is everyone else. And if words don't mean what they seem to mean, diplomatic words have never meant what they seem to mean. In a world, if I could be crude for a moment, in a world of bastards, Mr. Nixon's a very effective bastard. And a very successful one. And interestingly, before we condemn this too highly, he has brought about arrangements with some of our arch enemies which could not have been arranged in any other way. But the international world is a society utterly without law. And America is a society under law. And on the domestic scene, you simply can't operate the same way you do on the international scene. There are restraints. I was amused the other night when Mr. Nixon said during his press conference that Mr. Brezhnev would know how to handle and bring to an end Watergate. The two of a pod, two peas in a pod. They understand each other. He's right. But this isn't the Soviet Union. And here there are rights. The least of us has rights in some ways equal to the president, and the president stands under the law equally with the smallest of us. But he's been concerned with his success, his immortality, his record for history. Indeed, much of his own problem is of his own making. The famous tapes, what are they? But his, they were to be his immortality. They will be. But not in a way that he suspected, I'm afraid. With it all, and it's a sad and tragic situation, past for our nation. With it all, for the moment, I'm tempted to believe that we ought not to press immediately for a bill of impeachment. We should, if the president refuses to allow the creation either under the legislative branch or under the judicial branch of an independent investigator. If he insists on being suspect, judge, and jury, then we ought to move, because there's no other recourse, towards an act of impeachment. But if we can, in fact, proceed with the investigation by the special prosecutor, by the grand juries, by the Senate committee, by all others who will inevitably be involved in this, there's much to be gained. First of all, a record can be made, and all those who are involved can be trapped by their actions. Next, it may in fact be true that the president was not involved in the Watergate cover-up. A man under our society is assumed to be innocent until he's proven guilty, and that includes the president of these United States. The record ought to be uncovered and made clear. And then, too, I think in this long process of judicial process, all of us are slowly rediscovering our love, affection, respect, and belief in law. I was impressed last weekend by the average citizen in these United States. I was impressed by the torrential rise, you know, torrential outrage at the act of the president, by those who were willing, the average citizen who was willing to stand up and say, this cannot be tolerated, the tens upon tens of thousands of letters and telegrams which were written to the Congress people, to the White House, saying this is outrageous, it cannot be tolerated. We've come through a period, you and I, where from the left and from the right, we have been encouraged to be supercilious about the law, to believe that if we have convictions, we can impose these on these United States, not through the normal legislative or judicial reformist ways, but simply by demonstration, by act of will, by the exertion of power. And whether it was the mobs demonstrating in the street or the president acting from behind the curtains of his office, we've had for the last 10 years evidence upon evidence of these United States of people who were willing to subvert the traditional forms of democratic exchange and progress to gain immediately success for their particular convictions. However much I may have agreed with some of their proposals, I've always been of the belief that we have a legal remedy in these United States. Our representatives, our legislatures, and the courts. And that we ought to use these. And we ought to avoid ever setting ourselves against the law unless we feel ourselves, you know, absolutely beyond remedy. Because when we do, we are in a way acting as the President of the United States has been acting these last several years. We feel our cause to be just, and he does. We feel the times to be urgent, and he does. We feel that the means justify the ends, and again, he does, and he has. I don't know what the long-term result will be. Whether, in fact, the Congress will ever move to impeach the president, whether, if it does, he will be impeached. I do know that America is slowly rediscovering its roots and its biblical constitutional tradition of respect for law, and that's it to the good. I do know that we are discovering that there are men who are willing to stand up and to say to the president of the United States, no, this I will not do, and that is good. I do know that they're slowly developing a better balance between the major branches of our government, and that is good. Some good can come out of all of this. But a great deal that's harmful. And I can only end with a prayer that we will keep our heads and be vigilant and pray for these United States. Amen.